Charlene Hurst, who has replaced Bill. Ryan Lothrop, our technical guru extraordinaire. Kelly Cunningham is the director of our fish program. And I hope I haven't missed anybody.
Kurt, do you want to do the same for the Oregon side and then the commissioners can introduce themselves? What's your pleasure?
Chair Wall can do that.
Yeah, that's great. Or I'll let Kurt introduce the staff as well. And then we'll back up and introduce have the commissioners each introduce themselves. So Kurt, would you like to just mention the staff who are on?
Sure, yeah, good afternoon. I'm Kurt Melcher, Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have on the Zoom call here with us, Cedric Cooney, who's our Acting Fish Division Administrator, Chris Kern, who's the Deputy Fish Division Administrator, and Tucker Jones and John North from the Columbia River Program.
Great, thank you. Let's go to then, Larry, if you'd introduce yourself, and then if we could go to Vice Chair Baker and Commissioner Bob Kehoe and Commissioner McIsaac, if you could
Very each good.
Introduce
Thank you.
Yourselves.
Thank you, Chair Wall. My name is Larry Carpenter. I reside up in Mount Vernon. I've been on the commission for, I think, 8 years. It's been very, very enjoyable. I look forward to this discussion. I think we have a lot more in common with our Oregon counterparts than not. And look forward to a productive meeting today and into the future.
Thank Barbara? You. Vice Chair Baker.
Hello there, everybody. I am Barbara Baker. I've been on the commission about 4 years. I live in Olympia, so I'm in Western Washington, and I share the same sentiment. This is going to be productive, I think, both from getting a joint policy on the Columbia River, but also just getting to know you all better because we share a lot of the same issues.
Thank you. Welcome, Commissioner Kehoe.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Wall. My name is Bob Kehoe, and I've been on the commission since 2013, so about 7 years. And I am Boyd. I'm the executive director of a commercial fishing trade organization called We are the largest in terms of members, largest commercial fishing trade group on the West Coast. And you know, most of my work is in Alaska. That's where most of our but certainly we have members that participate in fisheries off your great coast of Oregon, California, and in Washington. Yes, and looking forward to knowing you folks better. And so thank you.
Thank you. And just so you know, Commissioner Kehoe, your voice fades out whenever you turn your head, it seems, but
yeah, I know. Thank you. It's got a bad computer here, so
Well, thank you and welcome, and I'm glad that we're doing this conversation. And let's go to Commissioner McIsaac for an introduction.
Yes, thanks very much. I'm Commissioner McIsaac, and I came on just after Commissioner Baker did, so we're on the same sophomore class. I'm not sure if that's the right phrase there, but by way of introduction, I think I know most of you folks at least a little bit peripherally, some of you ways back. And so maybe by introduction, I would just say I'm the retired executive director of the Pacific Fishery Management Council and was involved in this PRC process from its onset. And really do appreciate the fact that we're getting together here today and appreciate the exchange of letters to get this going and looking forward to a very productive meeting.
Thank you. Let's go to Commissioner Vice Chair Woolley from the Oregon side.
Thank you, Chair Wall. So I'm Greg Woolley, and I'm in my eighth year plus on extended duty. Our governor has appointments to fill, but you probably heard Portland's been pretty busy lately and she's had a lot of things to do. So I'm on as long as, or I'll serve as long as she'd like me to. I represent the Portland metro area and have a lot of background in natural resource management, worked for the Forest Service, the Nature Conservancy, and other organizations, and got started on this particular task in 2012 with Governor Kitzhaber, as you remember, putting forth our plan. So we're still going. So it's good to see you all.
Thank you. Commissioner Czarniewicz.
Yeah, I'm Jill Czarniewicz. I represent the first district of the legislative district, which is some of the metro area of west of Portland and some along the Columbia. I'm used to work for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so I have a background in biology, wildlife biology, wildlife science, and a lot of water law, as it turns out. I'm not a lawyer, but that's what I learned in my job. And I think I'm the second young, not youngest, but the second to the last put on the commission before the pandemic. So I've been here since September of 2019.
Thank you. And I'm Mary Wall, chair of the Fish and Wildlife Commission for Oregon. I'm from Langlois and represent the 4th Congressional District. Langlois, for those of you who don't know it, is in the southwest corner of the state. My background is a combination of ranching and conservation. My last day job was managing the watershed program for the city of Portland. My family has ranches on the south coast of Oregon, and my work now is at the nexus of ranching and conservation. Like others have said, I look forward very much to this conversation, appreciate people being here, and that includes staff, of course, as well as the people who are on the phone and listening or watching. People have spent a lot of time on these issues, on these Columbia River issues, and we appreciate everyone who's participating today. And to today, the topic is the revised Washington Commission policy that was adopted in September on the 11th by the commission. The outcome at the end of today that we hope for is a common understanding of policy, the revised policy C-3620, and that's it. That's what we hope to do today, is to walk away with a common understanding of what that policy is. We have an hour, we have a lot of staff on the phone and the commissioners as well. And if at the end of the day we've achieved our goal of walking away with having done a good job of providing everyone with a common understanding of what that policy is, that's terrific. This isn't the opportunity to argue the merits of the changes. It's a description of what the policy is. Not the whys and justifications, just what it is. And a note to staff, we have several of you on the phone. We've asked for your time to be here, and we would welcome your clarifications and perspective as well, so that we really do walk away with a clear understanding of what that revised policy is. Since we only have an hour, both Chair Carpenter and I will try to keep everyone sticking to the topic. And if we finish early, then as Kurt Melcher would say, we will give you back a few minutes of your life. Maybe we could start with Larry. If you'll introduce the staff who will be presenting the revised policy, that would be great.
Okay, there we go. Well, I guess originally, and I don't know if Ron Warren's on here or not, we were going to have Bill Twight and Ryan Lothrop do that. I don't know. Has there been some changes in that, Don, that I haven't heard of with certainty, or are we still going down that pathway? I thought that was the right way to do it, but I'll...
Yeah. So maybe it's good to speak to the agenda here to start with. What we had published as the agenda was kind of in response to the letters that were exchanged, and it had two agenda items. One was for you all to get a good understanding of the Washington action that was taken on September 11th. The second one was to discuss some joint state policy and regulatory concurrency. And so we'd been hoping to go through a process of answering any questions you might have on the Washington decision that was made and get you comfortable with, like you say, a complete understanding of that. We were interested also in getting an understanding of what Oregon is thinking of in terms of an approach to achieve joint state concurrency of policy and regulations. We did note in your letter, Chair Wall, that you said that this was a time to begin the process to achieve such concurrency and not at this meeting discuss any issues of substance. So that's, I think, an important matter to not get into that. But I do think it's, we were hoping to hear from you all about what you're thinking of in terms of moving forward and striving to achieve concurrent policy and regulatory business. We're hoping maybe at the end of this meeting that we would have a chance to talk about what the next steps are in that. So we had a little different view of what the agenda for the meeting was, again, feeding off the letters. And I guess maybe we could start by seeing if you have any objection to segmenting part of the meeting off for a discussion of what the approach might be in moving forward, the approach and the process only, not the substance.
Don, if I may, that's fine. Mary can address that as she sees fit. I do think we should get started with the presentation from staff, because I think that's the initial concern that we hear from Bill and Ryan. Mary, do you want to comment on that?
I would like to go ahead with what I outlined. And at the end, if we want to spend a minute just saying what you're looking for on a joint state policy discussion, we're not ready to talk about that, or at least I'm not ready to talk about that today. I think that we will do well to get through a description of what the revised Washington policy is, and was really hoping to do that. It's fine with me to spend a minute at the end just saying what that policy, joint policy, state policy discussion is, but I think our goal needs to be, let's talk about what the revised policy is.
Mary, I see Director Susawin's face on our screen. Director, did you have a comment?
No, I was just going to say that our staff would be Mr. Twight and Mr. Lothrop.
Okay. Could we start with that? Okay, Ryan and Bill.
Pause for a moment while Ryan's unmuting and all that. So we have been trying to systematically track the differences between the two state policies over time. And Ryan's developed a tool that he's now bringing up. It's my understanding that this has been back and forth between Oregon and Washington staff and represents our best collective understanding of where we've got, where we continue to have commonality between the two policies and where we now have differences. In some cases, I'll just remind everybody that the differences aren't always differences in all years. So for instance, the abundance-based provisions that are now part of the Washington policy for allocation are in certain years, the allocations remain the same as with Oregon. And then in other years, when abundances rise, that's when the allocations begin to diverge. So we may talk about years, like we expect that in retrospect in 2020, there would not have been as much divergence between the two policies as you might expect based on a lot of the comments that have been going on around those two. But if spring Chinook abundance were to suddenly double on us, you begin to see more of those. And so keep that in mind as Ryan walks through this, that again, some of these are somewhat conditional, and staff will do our best to sort of keep you updated as to what we think, you know, the next year, the next couple of years might look like. But again, those are just our, those are our guesses. Take them for what they're worth. With that, turn it over to Ryan.
Good afternoon, Chair Wall, Chair Carpenter. So on the screen, I want to do a check. Are you seeing a PDF color-coded table? I'm just trying to make sure.
It's good, through. Ryan.
Okay, perfect. And I apologize for not looking at the camera because I have two screens, and once I get it to work, I don't want to mess things up. So bear with me. If I'm not looking at you, it's because I'm looking at what you're looking at. And we can, if commissioners choose to want to look at the details of the policy, I can pull up that document. I do have it open, but this is more of a summary of what changed. So let me orient you on the sheet. The blue column is just the issue or item or discussion point. Original references policies C3620 as adopted in 2013 and modified in 2017 of where we would be essentially today. The current is what was changed on September 11th this year. And then the Oregon rule, the kind of a salmon color there, that's our understanding of the Oregon rule. As Bill mentioned, we did do some checks on a few things, but I do ask that Oregon speak up if I mischaracterize anything, because you know your rule better than I do. So what we have it broken out by essentially species. So we have spring Chinook first, followed by summer, fall Chinook, coho, and then the other measures category. And I should make a note that under the original policy, and there are other elements not listed here, such as direction to work on predation or pursue commercial sustainable certification. But that's not categorized under here because this is more or less showing the current Washington policy and what changed. So under spring, we have Washington changed their allocation setting from what would have been 80-20 to an abundance-based approach, which under the previous, I believe, 10 years or maybe 15 years would be a 70-30 average sharing. So basically the way that works, high abundance period, you would have a higher allocation or have more allocation shifting to the commercial and losing a few, a little bit to the sport. Under a low run size scenario, it would be the opposite, more going to the sport. So a comparison, in a low run size scenario, the Oregon rule of 80-20 might actually be concurrent with the Washington abundance-based approach. That's just one way to look at this. Under moderate runs, there would be a, you know, a difference between 70-30 and 80-20. And then under the next row there is the allowable gear. The Washington policy changed from no main stem gear to basically full flexibility of gear and by time. And so what that means is alternative gear, which does include tangle nets, and then also gill nets at any period, so pre and post update. The caveat to this is it's to provide full flexibility to for fishery managers, decision makers to consider the most selective gear available and also strive to be concurrent with the Oregon. So that's the direction we have under the policy. Moving on down, so I'm going to move, that's the spring Chinook sport allocation. So we have a 75% below Bonneville and 25% above Bonneville. And that's shared at a 10% in the zone six of Bonneville to the Oregon-Washington state line and 15% to the Snake. The Washington policy changed that to 70-30. So basically moving 5% out of below Bonneville to the Snake River, which just for everyone's reference is in Washington. It's not a jointly managed fishery. And then just under the unused impacts, just provided it changed from previous direction to basically providing full flexibility of unused impacts. So maybe I'll pause on Spring Chinook, unless chairs would prefer me to just walk through this first.
It works for me if you just keep going, unless anybody has a question, and I'll check for hands up, but I don't see any yet. What about you, Chair Carpenter?
No, I'm fine as well. Thank you for that, Mary.
Okay. Thank you. So moving on to Summer Chinook. So the Washington policy, and I should reference this, that this is only for the allocation below Priest Rapids Dam. So above Priest Rapids does not change, which the majority of the allocation goes up there. For below Priest Rapids, the Washington policy changed from 80-20 sharing to an abundance-based approach, similar to Spring Chinook. And so under normal or recent return run sizes, that would average up to 70-30. And I should make mention, I failed to mention this, both Spring and Summer Chinook abundance-based matrix do align with the USV Oregon breakpoint. So it just provides a little... It simplifies things for the fishery managers a bit. And then moving out down to unused impacts, again, changed from moving the unused commercial impacts to the sport fishery upstream or spine escapement to providing full flexibility, so just no restrictions. And allowable gear is essentially the same as during the spring period. It's full flexibility, considering the most selective tool available, and strive to meet the concurrence with Oregon. So that's summer. And moving on to fall, it is Washington moved their allocation from a no more than 80% sport and no less than 20% commercial to 70-30 sharing, which actually is concurrent with Oregon. And the gear is basically, as I referenced before, full flexibility, considers the most selective gear available and any zone, and also strive to achieve concurrence with Oregon. Alternative gear allocation, or if you see Oregon does specifically speak to the allocation, but Washington is more generic in the sense of pursued, and implement alternative gear. It just provides a clear direction in that measure. Coho, it's no change, prioritized by fishery segment. And under gear, changes from alternative gear only, so previously that basically meant tangle net or seine gear, moves on to a full suite of tools, which include alternative gear, tangle net, and consideration of gill net. But basically, again, the direction is selectivity and concurrency with Oregon. Under the other measures, there's several items here that the policy speaks to. Increased alternative gear development implementation provides clear direction to pursue. The old policy did not, or the previous version of the policy did not speak to hatchery and natural production goals. The new policy directs us to pursue to increase production. Both spoke to previously and currently spoke to commercial license reduction program. The new updated policy speaks to working with Oregon on that. The next item is limitation of recreational fishing guides and charter licenses. That was not addressed in the previous policy, but is to consider pursuing with Oregon on that measure. Excuse me. Under scientific monitoring, I might just caveat that we, as scientists and biologists, we always are trying to improve how we do things. But this speaks specifically to that, and we pursued it under the previous version of the policy, and it addresses it, and there are elements that speak to observation as well, and data collection. And then under thermal angling sanctuaries, it was our old version of the policy did not address this. The current policy does request us to discuss that matter with Oregon. And then I also want to make note that the barbless hook measure, the previous version of the policy spoke to mandatory barbless hooks. The current policy does not speak to that, but I should reference that we are in the main stem barbless hooks, and the Washington tributaries are largely allow the use of barbed hooks. That's where we are today. So I will stop right there, catch my breath, and see if there's any questions.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. I'm looking for any hands up. Commissioners, especially from the Oregon side, if you have questions you'd like to ask to understand it so far, and then we can get other people to add to the description as well. So,
Chair, well, I have a question. So thanks for your presentation, Ryan. So could you talk a little bit more about what would influence your decisions around gear selection for spring Chinook? You talked about the most selective tool. And so can you talk any more about what would influence those decisions?
Yes, I can. Thank you. And I ask other managers to speak to what they might consider as well. But when we consider what gear makes sense at a time and place, it's what are you targeting? What are you trying to avoid? Selectivity is basically just what I'm referring to. So, but there are some challenges we've run into. We know with small mesh like tangle net, if you start fishing close to when the shad show up, it becomes a problem. So that's something you want to avoid. You can avoid fishing earlier. You can, pre-update. You can basically just be catching spring chinook in a sense. You're not catching shad or sockeye too that do show up in the later part of the post-run update time period. So that's essentially mid-May on, that's kind of where we kind of get pinched or squeezed on using tangle nets. So I guess selectivity didn't quite answer your question specifically, but that's how I would approach it on what gear to consider is what you're trying to target and avoid. I mean, other seasons, time and place. So large mesh, if I speak to large mesh gill net in the fall, maybe that's an easier one to kind of describe. 9-inch mesh is large enough to avoid, it's steelhead basically. So you're being selective and targeting chinook just because of the sheer size of the net gap. So a lot of the steelhead swim through, so you lower your impacts on steelhead. So that's another way to kind of, for me, to think about being selective with the gear available versus if you throw a small mesh gear in there, you might catch a lot of steelhead, and the sheer number, even with a low mortality rate, might actually exceed steelhead impacts rather than what a large mesh gill net might do when you go fishing. So those are things I would consider, but I would open the door, the question to other managers on the phone for that answer or their answer.
Other managers to add to that one?
Yeah. I mean, that's sufficient. If there aren't any other, additional comments, that's fine. Thank you, Ryan.
Do you have another question, Vice Chair Woolley?
Not necessarily. I know it's been a while since we've talked about buyback, but I was trying to kind of stretch in my brain and remember what our discussions were previously, but we don't have to go into that now. That's all right.
We can come back in a minute if you want to ask it later. Commissioner Czarnowitz, it looks like you have your hand up. Go ahead.
On the barbless hooks, I didn't quite understand what you said, that you said they were allowed in the tribs, but it looks like they're allowed in the main stem too.
Yeah, so sorry. Let me rephrase that so it's a little more clear on my end for you guys. So the previous version of the C-3620 required the use of barbless hooks, which did align, or I guess does align with the Oregon rule. So the Columbia River Basin, in a sense, on the Washington side was barbless. The new, there was a modification a year and a half ago, I believe, that changed that to allow barb hooks. So where we currently sit today, well, I should pause there. Then was the main stem was adjusted to go back to barbless hooks because the Oregon rule was temporary, I believe, that allowed the use of barbed hooks. And so currently where we are today is in the main stem, we are barbless hooks where we jointly manage the fisheries. In Washington only waters, outside of a few specific areas, like I believe the Snake River, we do allow the use of barbed hooks still due to the change in the Washington policy, the interim change a year and a half ago. So there's a difference between where you are within the Columbia Basin, but in jointly managed waters, it's 100% barbless hooks.
I'd like to just expand on that briefly because that brings up an important point that actually occurs at several places in here. Staff's decisions are even where the policies offer different levels of flexibility, and the barbless hooks one is a great one where the Washington policy allows some flexibility, the Oregon rule doesn't. We go to the guidance that has the most specificity in each case. So the concurrent regulations are in effect guided by the Oregon rule in barbless hooks. Both Washington and Oregon in the concurrent waters follow the Oregon rule because that has the most specificity. Similarly, if you look up at say something like under spring Chinook unused commercial impacts, right now the Washington policy offers staff flexibility. The Oregon rule provides specificity that it needs to go to escapement. That means that if the managers in season in the compact confront a decision about what to do with unused commercial impacts, the Oregon rule will prevail because it provides more specificity. And that's important, first off, just to understand how the concurrency works, but it's also important for you to think about as commissioners, as you look down this list, it could appear to be a pretty daunting list of areas where we're different. Point I'm making is that from a staff perspective, there's not an issue with concurrency. When one state has more flexible guidance and the other state has more prescriptive, we achieve concurrency by adopting the more prescriptive one. And so some of these things don't pose problems for concurrency. It's just when both states' guidance, either the Washington policy or the Oregon rule, are both equally specific, but they're specifically different, if you follow my meaning.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Commissioner Zarnowitz, do you have another question now, or do you want to come back to it? Then I have a couple that I'd like to ask at this point, and then we can see also if the Washington commissioners have clarifying questions as well. One is that the revised policy mentions additional monitoring needed to, I think the term was, properly monitor stock status. Could you just describe what that is or what it's, you know, I don't need the exact specifics on it, but if you could talk about what that additional monitoring is to properly monitor the stock status, that would be useful.
Yes, Chair Wall. So my quick answer on that is, I would view it as we need to be able to assess what the population is and also the catch impacts associated with it. So that's sport and commercial fisheries, in my view, covers both. We don't have to have a census to handle every single fish out there in every location to get that estimate. We can come in and do periodic check-ins on our approaches, our models, but it's to assess the catch and understand where we provide will improve precision on where we are with associated allowable ESA impacts as well. So that's my short answer, but I'm sure we can get into more depth real quick.
Other staff have any additions on that?
This is Bill. I just want to emphasize one of the points Ryan made, that we're looking, when we say harvest impacts, we're talking about both landed catch as well as bycatch.
But you are talking about beefed up monitoring from what we currently have of adults, of adult returners, in order to monitor the stock status. Is that what it means?
So Chair Wall, that only can really happen if we get increased resources to pull that off, because we, you know, just like across the river, I'm sure you're stretched thin like we are. But there are ways for us to improve our ability to do that. I mean, an example is we could consider using electronic monitoring to do that instead of putting a person on board. So being strategic on our approach, and in areas where we have very ample and robust fishery sampling, but we have a little flexibility to shift resources, we can consider that too. So I see it as multidimensional approach to get there.
Thanks, that's helpful. We've talked a lot about changes in, I would call it, the allocation and gear type parts of the policy. We haven't talked about policy changes relative to directions on the recovery and conservation of the stocks. Do you see changes in this policy to that part? If we look at the policy as basically divided into three objectives or goals, with conservation and recovery of the resource being one of them, orderly fisheries being one of them, and the parts that you have talked about being the third one, the economic and stability for the industry, are there key policy changes or direction changes on the recovery and conservation objective or goal?
So this is Bill. I'll take a first crack at that, Chair Wall. I think the answer is mixed. First off, this policy is founded on existing conservation requirements that are found either in the Endangered Species Act, limitations that we have, that as well as the USV Oregon agreements regarding optimal escapements, as well as our other salmon recovery obligations. There's a host of state level, state tribal level, and federal conservation requirements. And the C3620, the intent was always to provide guidance to improve how we were addressing some of those where we were either couldn't identify the tools at the time, didn't see the tools, or where we knew we were falling short. For instance, the ability to manage hatchery returns, where excessive hatchery returns has been identified as a major impediment or risk to achieving delisting, and then obviously recovery after that. To just sharpen and improve our tools and our approaches for achieving those existing conservation objectives. The five-year review pointed out several areas where we were falling short. For instance, our ability to increase selectivity through development of alternative gears. And restructure commercial fishery so that it is a viable tool into the future for both providing consumers with seafood, but equally for helping us manage hatchery returns so that we can keep those in balance with our salmon recovery needs. So the five-year review identified several of those areas where we were falling short, and in the revisions that are intended to address those areas, those revisions are intended to improve our ability to meet our conservation and recovery objectives.
Thank you. I want to check before I go through a few more of my questions, if either Commissioner Woolley or Commissioner Zarnowitz have additional questions at this point.
I have a question, Chair Wall.
Yeah, go ahead, Commissioner.
Okay. So you mentioned that you are planning to discuss thermal sanctuaries with Oregon. As you know, we've established some rules for some thermal sanctuaries here in our state, some tributaries leading into the Columbia. Have you begun any of those discussions within your own agency at this point?
This is Bill Twight. I'm sorry, I actually couldn't pick up quite all of that, particularly faded out at the question I heard at the end.
Okay, the question is, have you begun any discussions regarding thermal sanctuaries within your agency at this point?
Yes. So first off, we continue to have extensive communication with your agency about the both the existing ones as well as other issues, other thermal issues that are posed. And then within our own agency, we continue to, there are some areas where we are already actively managing known thermal angling, known areas where angling can pose problems when thermal conditions become adverse, when particularly when river temperatures have increased. And we've been actively managing those areas for several years. We're continuing to look for other areas where there may be similar situations. And then both we and Oregon are also beginning to confront just the general thermal regime issues in the Columbia that 2015 sort of brought into the relief as well. So we're looking at it both in terms of specific locations, but equally in terms of how would we react in the future to another 2015 year when it's not just a few areas that have potential thermal impacts, it's much broader than that, and continuing to do some planning for that as well. We still have quite a ways to go in these discussions. It's an area that I view as sort of constantly evolving in terms of the challenges that are being posed to us as managers.
Okay, so just to clarify, when you say you're addressing them, you're discussing them. That's what you mean.
Well, again, there are areas of Drano Lake, for instance, on our side is an area. It's in the gorge. It's an area that's actually, it is connected to the Columbia, and that's an area it's a known area where steelhead, in particular, that are passing up river, will often move into that area seeking thermal refuge. In some years, that's not a problem at all, even though there's a heavy amount of angling pressure in that. In other years, it's often a significant problem. We monitor that in season, and while we don't have a fixed criteria for when we would close that, we have in many years, including the last year, a couple of years, when B-run steelhead are in such poor shape, we've managed it very conservatively right from the beginning to minimize the impacts, the angling impacts on that thermal on the steelhead making use of that thermal sanctuary.
Okay. So at this point you have no prohibition of angling in any thermal sanctuary.
Not fixed, but it's an in-season management tool that we don't hesitate to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, thanks, Bill.
Thanks. Commissioner Zarnowitz, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering what you have pursue for increasing alternative gear development, and what is the strategy there? And I'm gonna turn on a light because I'm gonna fade away here because I'm using natural light. But I'll listen first to your comment.
Thanks, Commissioner. So we have. During the first 5 years, and again, our five-year review provided, I think, a pretty good overview of our work to date. We've worked hard to develop both purse and beach seines during the first 5 years, put quite a bit of money into studies of their efficacy, as well as estimating what the mortality rates are of steelhead in particular that are encountered and then released, but also unmarked Chinook as well. And found that in that time period, using the methods that we were able to use, we were seeing higher mortality rates than we'd anticipated initially, reducing the potential value of those two gears. Since then, we have, working in cooperation with an NGO, Wild Fish Conservancy, we've switched to evaluating pound nets, which are a fixed gear, essentially, in a way, a modernized fish trap, and have been refining how that works and are seeing some, at this point, some pretty positive potentials working with pound net. And so most of our current investigative work is with the pound net. There's one site that's up and running. There's another one that's, we're hoping to start the permitting process, or actually our partner NGO and the commercial fishermen they work with are hoping to start the permitting process within the next few months. And that still would be a year away or so, but we're seeing promise there. We're also looking for opportunities to circle back and maybe refine some of the work we've done with the seines to further reduce the mortalities there, which every bit that you can reduce your estimated mortality on released fish really increases the value and the economic viability of both purse seines and beach seines. And so we continue to look for opportunities to do that. The most exciting development right now that's coming out of the pound net is what's called a no-handle release, where they keep the fish in the water the entire time and essentially use just a series of gates to direct fish underwater, either into the harvest gate or the release gate. And the initial indications on that are that is achieving a far better survival rate than some of the other techniques that we've seen work with. So we're hopeful about that, but it's still early. And this is work that still has yet to be peer reviewed too. And peer review of the mortality estimates is a requirement before they can actually be used. May have been a little bit more than you were looking for, but that's kind of a thumbnail on where we're at this point.
Oh, that was great. Do you have the commercial fisheries industry starting to get interested in it? Because at one of our PRC meetings, they were pretty opposed to it.
There's a broad gamut of I think, commercial reactions to it. But most of them are still looking at the reports we've produced and what they've seen to date, and they're still not sure how they're going to make it pencil out. And there's two reasons for that. One is that as we work these in a test fishery sort of approach, that by its nature limits the amount of catch that we're actually going to have. And so they're not seeing the size of harvest that they think makes sense. And secondly, as they consider the very large capital costs, particularly of either trap or purse seine, they don't at this point see how they could recoup those kinds of capital costs. So it's an issue we're going to have to deal with. But first, we need to make sure we've got a gear that's attractive enough to even make it worthwhile to dive into that issue. But there's some ideas on how to address those capital costs should we get to that point. We hope we will.
Thank you.
Bill, could I ask a follow-up question? And it's going to sound like a very basic one on the pound nets. You do consider those clearly within the category of alternative gear. Is that right? By implication, correct. It sounded like it, but I just want to be clear that that is alternative gear work.
Yes.
Okay, thanks. That helps in terms of understanding it. Let me shift gears just a little bit and go back to the EPA report on thermal angling sanctuaries. One of the pieces in the policy talked about staff direction to collect and review thermal angling sanctuary information. What is the information? What is that beyond what EPA has already reviewed and then subsequently reported and made recommendations on in terms of sanctuaries and where those might be effective?
That's not an issue that we have really scoped out fully. We had an initial proposal for legislative funding that unfortunately did not make it through the process. That proposal, we were going to use some bottom profiling, so field measurements of the bottom profile to take a look for areas where we actually could see fish congregating during the fish migration season. So essentially going beyond what we know now from angler success and actually going out and using sonar in areas that we thought might be sanctuaries. That was going to be a fairly expensive endeavor to try to locate additional areas where fish are concentrating. Because it didn't get funded, we haven't been able to do it. So at present, we're still paying close attention to where anglers are catching fish as our best indicator of where fish are concentrating. And so far, that really hasn't changed from what we've known for quite a while. But we continue to track where anglers are, where they're being successful as closely as possible to see if, as temperature regimes change on us in the Columbia, if we discover essentially new evidence of areas that deserve closer attention through our management. And thermal sanctuaries are one tool, or the in-season kind of closures, targeted closures that we've employed are another tool.
Thank you. We're getting low on time. I have one last question I'd like to ask, and then I'll check with the other commissioners as well. Do the revisions increase a focus on conservation and recovery goals? I do understand what you said about the basis of, or the foundation of what we have done is meeting ESA requirements and the some of the other pieces, the optimal escapement. But are there any parts of this that would beef up our focus on conservation and recovery and looking at other actions that we could be taking there?
Not sure what I can add as staff. And so I was going to suggest maybe that's a better discussion item among commissioners, because I don't know what I can add as staff to our understanding of the intent of the commission when they passed that.
Yeah, maybe this is Don McIsaac. Maybe I can offer perspective on that if that works. Let me say that from a policy perspective of one commissioner anyway, I think the new policy does do, actually quite a few things to advance consideration of conservation matters beyond what our old policy did. I think Bill Twight did a very nice job of describing how the biggest thing in conservation in most people's minds is overfishing. And what does this new policy do about overfishing? And all of the overfishing protections are pretty well already baked into the whole system in terms of ESA compliance, no jeopardy opinions, the long tradition of meeting hatchery escapement goals. And this plan will have that all continue on into and have that excellent performance that we've seen from both of our staffs continue. But just to be clear, there is no added fishing pressure in this new plan. So all of the conservation goals that have to do with fishing pressure are to be complied with, and we have great confidence the staff will do that. But maybe in some other areas that do help get a little bit of focus on improvements in more selective alternative commercial fishing gear, which gets into the conservation of genetic resources by improving PHAS goals. And this plan does talk about how to move more toward the original goal in 2012 that just didn't get there. And it was a noble goal to start with, but because of a variety of reasons, it just didn't get there. And so there's policy advocacy in this new plan to try to do a better job of moving toward that. And Commissioner Woolley's, one of his original questions on spring Chinook is one example there where we're directing our seat at the Columbia River Compact in the spring, for example, to if there's a choice between using tangle nets or gill nets for spring Chinook, to use tangle nets before the shad. The catch and release mortality from tangle nets is approximately the same as it is for the sport fishery. And this is an alternative gear from gill nets that's had a lot of research. And it's, I think, the difference between 10 and 14% or something like that. So that's one, more selective gear. There's also a policy initiative to consider thermal refugia with you all in terms of a regulatory approach. So a conservation when the water is hot in the Columbia River, and looking forward to what that might be in the future. It's calling for an advocacy to sit down with you and talk about that. We had talked a little bit about putting some language in there about climate change, but we didn't quite get to that alternative. But at the Washington Commission level, we did have a discussion of when we do sit down with you all to bring about that. That's a conservation measure. There's a new policy guideline to advance the conservation of non-ESA listed salmon and steelhead populations, and there was no such guideline in our whole policy. So that's another one. There's conservation language in two locations regarding the emphasis for hatchery enhancements to be done in a manner that grossly minimizes genetic and ecological impacts to wild salmon and steelhead populations. Now, both states have trying to direct language to try to focus and bolster that attitude. There is conservation for something other than salmon and steelhead in here. There's a conservation speaking about southern resident killer whales by accommodating some initiatives to try to increase their preferred prey. And that would have some shirt tail benefits to fisheries. But the idea is that those would be shirt tail benefits. No fishery would be intensified to catch more hatchery fish from increased production for the primary purpose of killer whale prey enhancement. It's a shirt tail benefits. So those are a few just that I recall us talking about as we were debating the new language that I see at least as one commissioner.
Thank you. Are there any last questions to clarify what's in the revised policy, or commissioners from Washington, you, the other commissioners, you haven't had a chance. Is there anything you wanted to add to clarify this?
Nope. Well, Chair Wall, an hour goes by quickly. I think this was a great start. I think we will, to be continued, I guess, would be my closing statement. I thought the questions by you folks were very appropriate. I hope the responses that were given by our staff and commissioner were good, and we plan to stay engaged.
That sounds great. And yes, at least I can speak for myself, and I bet I can speak for the other Oregon commissioners. It was helpful to have this, and I appreciate very much that we've opened the conversation. And we have a long way to go, and we can talk again later. But I think that we did what we needed to do today, which was clarify what's in there and in the revised proposal or the revised policy. So I think that we can end there, except it looks like Commissioner Kehoe has.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Wallen. I'm not clear about Maybe if you could maybe just let you know, the Washington folks kind of know what you're thinking in terms of next steps. I mean, I know this has been a good meeting, but just wondering if you guys have got, are you scheduled to have another meeting to talk about what to do next, or just kind of curious as to what your process and timeline is?
Well, the short answer is no, we have not figured out next steps, and we would not do that on our own. We would talk first with the leadership from the commission in Washington so that we had that discussion jointly. We need a process, as several people have said, to come to long-term solutions on both the allocation and gear types part of this conversation, as well as on the recovery and conservation of the resource. And I think that those are conversations that have yet to be shaped. We have said that we would keep our conversations when we meet, because we are not the entire commissions, to what's the process to get there to those long-term solutions. So those would be the next conversations. But we have not set another meeting, and we have not looked to that yet.
So those conversations would then take place internally within the Oregon Commission?
Or jointly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Anything else? If not, then thank you to staff and to Washington in general for this, and to those of you who are participating, listening to us, thank you all for this and for doing what we needed to do today, which was get this figured out in terms of what's in the policy. So thank you all, and I look forward to what comes next.
Thank you as well from the Washington side.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you all.